From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Technological Nightmares, a lecture by renowned economist Professor Paul Streeton on the perils of technological development.
Scientific confidence, you know, assert that there is a solution to every problem. But experience shows that there is a problem to every solution, and indeed very often more than one problem to every solution.
Professor Emeritus Paul Streeton on the ways that technological progress can lead to unintended consequences. Also, the inaugural lecture for the Center for African American Religious Research and Education. That's tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. U.S. officials are trying to reach a compromise with North Korea to end the standoff over the communist government's nuclear weapons program. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
North Korea has demanded that the U.S. sign a formal treaty saying it will not invade the country. Otherwise, North Korea's president says he will continue his country's nuclear weapons program. Secretary of State Colin Powell told NBC's Face the Nation that the U.S. won't sign a non-aggression pact, but he's trying to find a middle ground.
We believe that we can provide the kind of assurances that the North Koreans say they are looking for without getting it into the formal process of a treaty. And we want it to be done in a way that involves all of the other parties in the region.
North Korea has been pushing for a bilateral agreement. The U.S., however, wants to involve four other countries that have been in talks with North Korea. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush says the broadcast of a new tape of a speaker purporting to be Osama bin Laden just shows that the war on terrorism must go on. The president is in Bangkok for an annual Asia-Pacific Economic Summit. NPR's Vicky O'Hara is there.
The tape, broadcast by the Arabic Al Jazeera television network, calls for more suicide attacks inside and outside of the United States. At a meeting with Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, President Bush said the broadcast illustrates the need for countries to work together to fight terrorism.
The bin Laden tape should say to everybody the war on terror goes on, that there's still a danger for free nations, and that free nations need to work together more than ever.
President Bush says he'll discuss cooperation against terrorism with other nations attending the annual summit of APEC. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Bangkok.
More than a quarter of a million people flooded St. Peter's Square today for the beatification of Mother Teresa. Pope John Paul honored the nun who built shelters, clinics, and orphanages around the world to care for the poor. Among those given reserved seats at the service were about 2,000 homeless men and women. Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain spent several hours in a hospital in London today. The BBC's Daniel Bercher says Blair was treated for an irregular heartbeat.
It's usually brought on by irregular electrical impulses to the heart. Doctors say it's not uncommon, even in otherwise healthy patients. The Prime Minister was in hospital for about 5 hours and underwent a series of tests, but he was well enough to be discharged and has now returned to Downing Street.
The BBC's Daniel Bercher. Fire investigators looking for the cause of Friday's blaze in a high-rise government office building in Chicago say malfunctioning light fixtures in the structure may be to blame. 6 people were killed in the fire. 8 others are still hospitalized. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Teachers in Billerica say they will no longer oversee any out-of-classroom activities beginning tomorrow. The teachers decided to take the action to protest their ongoing contract dispute. The teachers say they are underpaid compared to other towns in the area. A study due to be released next week says Massachusetts prisoners have some of the highest rates of infectious disease in the country. Citing the study from the Massachusetts Public Health Association, the Boston Globe reports that Massachusetts inmates have the 7th highest rate of HIV infections in the nation. And the cold drew a smaller-than-expected crowd to the head of the Charles Regatta today. The Princeton Training Center won the championship 8s men, leaving the U.S. rowing in third place. The Canadian team won the 8s women. Frederick Schock is the executive director of the regatta. He says today's weather was bad for the viewers, but good for the rowers.
From a competitor point of view, it was smooth. It was cool, which is fine for the competitors. They don't overheat, and the winds are the enemy of the rower, so we had very light winds both days.
In the course of both days, about 200,000 people attended the event, some 50,000 less than expected. In the forecast, tonight partly cloudy, 40 in downtown Boston, 30s in the suburbs. Tomorrow mostly sunny with a high around 55. Right now 40 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, MathWorks.com. By Goldsmiths 3, presenting a broad array of contemporary handcrafted fine jewelry by Robert Fairbank, John Reynolds, and other noted American artisans in Concord and online at goldsmiths3.com. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. We have two lectures for you this evening. Later in the program, we'll hear Professor Emeritus James Streeton on the ways that technological progress can lead to unintended consequences. But first, Boston University's School of Theology inaugurated its new Center for African American Religious Research and Education earlier this month with a series of public worship services and lectures honoring the late Dr. Prathia L. Hall, who inspired Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. On October 2nd, the Reverend Drs. Ray and Gloria Hammond, co-pastors of the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Boston, delivered from Marsh Chapel the center's inaugural lecture. The Reverend Drs. Ray and Gloria Hammond.
It is a blessing to be here with you today, and we are deeply grateful for this opportunity to share in this inaugural lecture. But we're all assembled on this historic occasion that looks back in tribute to the life of an extraordinary woman of God, and that looks forward to a bright future for the newly founded Center for African American Religious Research and Education at Boston University. I also never miss an opportunity whenever I speak at BU to express my eternal indebtedness to this university for admitting a young woman named Gloria White in 1968. Amen. I don't know if I would have met her otherwise. That young woman, a graduate of this august institution, wandered across that great divide called the Charles River, and there found, I hope, a good man, a good friend, and a good husband. She's been my friend and fellow laborer in the tasks of raising a family, building a church community, and making a contribution to this community. And after 30 years of marriage, and we just got back in the month of August. We took 30 days for 30 years just to spend some time together. I can never be thankful enough to her and to God for allowing me to be her husband.
Now, we are mindful of the fact that this is not listed as a sermon, but I don't know how you could expect to have two preachers honor another preacher without us taking a text. And so, actually, the text that we are reading from is it's from Mark 14, verses 3 through 9, and I'm going to read that in your hearing. While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard, and she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, "Why was this ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and the money given to the poor." And they scolded her. And Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has performed a good service for me. For you always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish, but you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." And so if we could pick a topic for this inaugural lecture, it would be, "Do This in Remembrance of Her." In this text, we encounter an extravagant gift from a woman who poured a precious perfume on the head of Jesus. Jesus, as he drew closer to the time of his death. In so many ways, the woman that we've come to honor today was like that woman with the alabaster jar. She made a sacrificial gift of love, her life, her work, her testimony, and it cost her so very much. It was an extravagant gift that went far beyond the bounds of common sense. It just didn't make no kind of sense. And it was a gift whose fragrance will last forever because it honored God.
These are the qualities that stand out in the life of the Reverend Dr. Prathia Hall. Born in my hometown of Philadelphia, she was a preacher's kid. She had a childhood of privilege, educated in schools outside her neighborhood, exposed to a wider society with music lessons and piano and voice, and field trips to Rittenhouse Square. Now, I don't know how many of you know Philadelphia, but that is the really she part of town, right? In Center City, Philadelphia, where she attended concerts and sometimes performed at the Society for Ethical Culture. She was on the fast track for a comfortable middle or upper class life. Her only problem was that she had been nurtured in what she would call freedom faith, the belief that she was God's child and was therefore loved and important. That freedom faith led her, after graduating from Temple University, to join the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where she became one of the first women field leaders in Southwest Georgia. As recounted in the PBS series, This Far by Faith, she helped Charles Sherrod to pilot SNCC's 22-county Southwest Georgia project. She was no stranger to the threat of death. Prathia was one of three voter registration workers wounded by Knight Rider shots in Dawson, Georgia, in the summer of 1962. Charles Sherrod recounted, "Out of the night that covered us pitch black, there were two blasts. Jack Chatfield, now an associate professor of history at Trinity College in Hartford, crouched, gliding into where I was. Suddenly he snaps around, explaining quite surprisingly, but not too excited, 'I'm hit.' Prathia Hall and Christopher Allen were grazed, one on the finger, the other on the arm. We were all on the floor. We were working together on voter registration. We had been shot at. Some were hit. There was blood. We were afraid. Where was the federal government? We crawled about on that floor as if we were in Korea on Pork Chop Hill."
She was there on Bloody Sunday, the date of the famous crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge during the march in Selma, from Selma to Montgomery. And as she recounted in a 1991 conversation with seminarians, it was in 1963. It was a terrifying moment in my own quest for the embrace of justice and peace in our world. I was one of a group of students working to achieve voting rights and political empowerment in Southwest Georgia. We were encouraging persons who had been prevented from participating in the political process by a pervasive campaign of terror. We were encouraging them to register to vote. Four of us were stopped by a man wearing a tin badge who told us that he was a deputized marshal. He asked us, "What were we doing?" I answered, "We are discussing voter registration, and you have no right to stop us." My answer infuriated him. He began to sputter and curse and tremble and literally foam at the mouth. Suddenly, he whipped out a gun and emitted a stream of exceedingly graphic expletives and began to fire bullets in a circle around my feet. I stood frozen in place. I did not move a muscle. Had I done so, he would have had this excuse to raise the gun and fire point blank. Finally, when the gun was empty, he seized us and threw us into jail. Was I frightened? My Lord, I was so terrified. I was numb. But I learned something that day about the shalom of God. I learned that the struggle for justice and peace is the shalom of God, and the shalom of God is both power and protection.
For these sacrifices, these extravagant sacrifices,
that went beyond the realm of common sense, she would be a truly American hero, and the fragrance of her life would last forever because it blessed humanity and honored God. To put it in the vernacular, this was one woman whose walk really matched her talk. What may be less well known to many is that this woman, so steeped in America's life and history, had a truly global perspective. Allow me to share with you some portions of her baccalaureate sermon preached to 3,000 worshipers on June 13, 1992, at Stanford University. She said, "You have a right to ask, when and where do justice and peace embrace? And how on earth do we get these evasive partners together that they may indeed kiss?" She had an incredible gift for imagery. Unbelievably wonderful. I must warn you, the questions and problems and challenges are far deeper, far more complex than those I have mentioned. You see, all over this world, there are people who are asking the same question, who are seeking the same embrace. Last year, I attended the 7th Assembly of the World Council of Churches in Canberra, Australia. There were councils and caucuses and meeting after meeting after meeting in search of the elusive goals of Christian unity and a global state of justice and peace and the integration of creation. Participating in these gatherings were indigenous peoples from around the earth, and for me, their anguished cries for vindication for the blood of their slaughter not only shaped the dialogue, but so permeated the atmosphere above and beyond the assembly that this very morning I can still hear them. I cannot forget them. It is not fair that you were called to fix and to settle and to heal a planet and its people, but this is the fact. We are passing to you with your diploma a planetary mess. And should you decide to opt out of the struggle and let the world go to hell in a handbasket, it will be suicide. For you, our only hope of a future, will go down with it. You must take seriously your own yearnings for justice and peace and the integrity of creation. Yours must be the quest for this elusive embrace. There is much talk today about the disappearance of the American dream. It may well be that the dream must disappear, that a greater vision might replace it. Yours must be a new vision, a global vision, a planetary vision. And as you live it, even wrestle with it, you will find within it the resources and direction for the next era, the next epic.
It is this vision for a new era, for a new epic, for a new way of being human that leads us to gather here today and to celebrate the life of Prathia Laura Ann Hall. Preacher, prophet, practitioner. By her life and leadership, she demonstrated that in the course of fighting oppression, you do not have to become like or succumb to those who oppress you, that the forces of evil are not always triumphant, and that bold women and courageous men everywhere possess the power to bring about change. Prathia should as much be remembered for the fact that she called America, and indeed all mankind, to task for failing to live up to its ideals. She should be remembered because even though she began with the pursuit of civil rights, she moved to the pursuit of gender rights, and along the way helped to set in motion a movement for human rights that continues to bear fruit for peoples of other colors, for women, for the disabled, and for other disadvantaged and oppressed people in this country and indeed around the world. Hers was a life that made a difference for all people, whether they were sharecroppers struggling for the right to vote, children fighting for the right to a decent education, Germans standing before the shattered ruins of the Berlin Wall, or African freedom fighters struggling against colonialism and apartheid. And now, even on this day, October 2, 2003, her vision still harnesses the hopes of an estimated 30 million people enslaved worldwide this day. From Thailand to Mauritania, From the United Arab Emirates to the United States, girls and boys and women and men are literally dying to overcome someday. In the text that we've read, like so many Bible stories about women, the writer does not even take the time to call the sister's name. I know that bothers some women, but frankly, I rather like it. It's like the Jane Doe phenomenon. She can be everybody, anybody. She can be somebody who has poured out her life on behalf of her Savior. She can be named Deborah, or Esther, or Harriet, or Sojourner, or Prathea. Everybody who has ever had a radical encounter with Christ, she can be everybody. Who meets Christ at the ground zero of her heart and allows him to tenderly clear out the rubble of sorrow and shame, allows him to gently sort through the debris of sickness and pain, and then lovingly pick up the remnants of our souls and proceed to re-knit them together into something beautiful and glorious. She can be everybody who does this thing in the remembrance of a preacher's kid from Sharon Baptist. She can be anybody who chooses to shamelessly shatter the confinements of race and decisively destroy the constraints of gender, to recklessly pour out her love on God and God's people without ever counting the costs. She can be anybody who declares that I will not rest until freedom comes. She can be anybody who does it in remembrance of the freedom fighter from SNCC. She can be somebody who's ever had a dream of that day spoken of in Psalm 85, when mercy and truth are met together and righteousness and peace have kissed each other. She can be somebody who, by her deeds and her actions, screams out to injustice and selfishness with the righteous indignation of a woman who gets sick and tired of being sick and tired and declares, no more. No more oppression, no more injustice, no more greed, no more war, no more, I say no, no more. And says it in remembrance of her, the preacher, the prophet, the practitioner, Prathea. Do this, I say, in remembrance of her. Bless you.
The Reverend Drs. Ray and Gloria Hammond delivering from Marsh Chapel, the inaugural lecture for Boston University's newly founded Center for African American Religious Research and Education. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. We now hear the first of two lectures recently given by renowned economist Professor Paul Streeton. Professor Streeton is the founding chairman of the editorial board of World Development, a monthly journal exploring ways of improving standards of living. Throughout his career, he has worked with several UN bodies, including the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and UNESCO. He is currently a visiting professor of future studies at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. In his first of two lectures, together entitled Technological Nightmares, Professor Streeton will examine the ways that technological progress can lead to unintended consequences. Professor Streeton.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to be back at Boston University, which I left about 10 or 12 years ago. I am very grateful to you for having forced me in a way to go outside my normal field, development economics, and think about the future and about technology and technological nightmares, which is completely outside my my normal field. So I'm very, very grateful. Well, perhaps I should begin by saying that I'm not a Luddite, which the title Technological Nightmares may suggest. Luddites, you remember, are those who, following Ned Ludd or General Ludd or King Ludd, were people who are known for irrational resistance to technical progress. Of course, they themselves were heavily affected by it, by it goes back to the early 19th century, the late 18th century. And they were the ones who smashed machinery because it caused... I think the normal assumption is, and I think that is a wrong one, because they were against technical progress. They were not against technical progress. They were against having the machinery in factories and taking them out of their normal cottages in which they previously had been allowed to work. And that, of course, was not tolerated by the government. And many of them were punished for this. And by the year 1813, 24 Luddites had been hanged, which is not a very nice face to suffer. So, but I'm not against technical progress, as you will see. I think we'll talk about that more fully. There were, of course, numerous movements. For instance, there was in the 70s in Cambridge a George Corry Society, the purpose of which was to put obstacles in the way of technical progress. And more recently, of course, you know, we remember the Unabomber who had also his own objections to it. And the indictment was not just to the unemployment that was caused by the new machinery, as it clearly was in the early days of the spinning jenny and the power loom. But the indictment goes beyond that. It is the depersonalization and the regimentation of work, the alienating replacement of community and conversation by television and net surfing. But one person's technological outrage is another's miraculous salvation. And of course, if we remember what the situation was like before the introduction and the growth of technology in the 19th and 20th century, we must remember that the work in the villages was horrible. It was the pre-industrial village was for most people a place of exhausting and unremitting subsistence labor, harnessing men, women, and children to the mind-numbing tasks of farm and household. So I'm very much aware of the benefits the technical progress has brought. It has raised not only productivity and wages, it has produced lots of new goods and improved old goods and services. It has produced a much longer life in good health. And half the things we spend our money on today were not even available in 1870. That is, from air travel to zip fasteners. The reduction in household drudgery, particularly for women, of course, is enormous, and I think one should welcome this. I do not believe, as the doomsayers on the environmental field seem to think, that technology inevitably leads to horrible pollution, raw material exhaustion, degradation of the environment into doom. There are prophets of doom, like Paul Ehrlich, who have predicted now, wrongly, I think, for decades, that the world is coming to an end. I have different kinds of worries from those that the doomsayers of technology. In fact, I have six worries or six concerns, to which I'll come after a somewhat, perhaps, excessively lengthy introduction. Maybe I won't reach it today. I don't know whether I'll reach it today or next week. The six concerns or six worries. But they are of a somewhat different kind for the ones that are usually quoted. The first Club of Rome report, if you remember, perhaps not to remember, but in 1972 it came out, was called Limits to Growth. And most of its predictions, in fact, all of its predictions are entirely wrong. They predicted that the world will come to an end more or less either because of excess pollution or because of raw material exhaustion or because of population growth. I remember, by the way, when I worked for a few years in the British Ministry of Overseas Development, we had a permanent secretary called Sir Andrew Cohen, And he always unconsciously and innocently coupled pest control with population control. These are the two concepts that he had, that we were much concerned with. And we always tried to wean him from this. But population growth was one of the concerns, or excessive population growth, of these doomsayers in the first Club of Rome report called Limits to Growth. Now, there may be some of these things like global warming and desertification and so on, species exhaustion, they may have. I'm not going to discuss them, but I'm going to take somewhat different concepts, somewhat different concerns or worries. I would suggest that economic progress and technological progress does not necessarily have to take these horrible forms of pollution and raw material exhaustion. Now, there are some people, you may have come across them, I don't know if they still exist. In my earlier years, they were quite vocal, who advocate zero economic growth in order to meet the challenge of the environment and all that. I think zero economic growth does not really solve. If you believe in what is called hard sustainability, that you think that certain raw materials will be inevitably exhausted after a certain time, then zero growth doesn't solve your problem. If you want hard sustainability, that means that you want to maintain your stock of exhaustible raw materials, you have to be not in favor of zero growth, but instead of zero consumption, that is to say we must all abolish all forms of consumption, which would mean, of course, the end of the human race. And that, I don't think, is what these people want. Hard sustainability is, in fact, I think, nonsense. In many forms of growth, many forms of economic growth have taken forms which have not been either raw material exhaustion or heavily polluting. So we have basically four options of growth. We can either, if we assume that growth is accompanied, that economic growth is accompanied by not only the production of goods, but also the production of bads, whether you call bads pollution or any other bad effects of it, and the two are complementary, although you can choose to some extent how they go together, you can opt for less slower growth, which of course simply postpones the day of exhaustion of materials, fewer goods, therefore, and fewer bads. That is one option. The second option would be for more the production of more anti-bads, that is to say, like scrubbers, which prevent the pollution, and with the resources reallocated to the production of anti-bads. Whether that shows up as more growth or as less growth depends on your accounting convention. Whether you count, for instance, anti-bads as necessary conditions of production, in which case they don't add to the productive process, or whether as net additions, in which case they may look like faster growth, differently composed. Now, the third option would be to opt for even faster growth, even more goods and faster growth, to compensate for the bads that you produce with the goods. And the fourth option, which would be my own preference, would be a different kinds of goods with fewer of the characteristics that cause the bads, like slower but also less polluting cars, like hydrogen fuel-driven automobiles, for instance. There are three types of technology. One that is frightening from the start. When the first atom bomb was detonated in Alamogordo in New Mexico in 1945, everybody knew that something terrible has been released on the world. Potential for destruction is enormous. And there's a need for regulating that type of technology. On the other hand, there is also completely benign, or almost completely benign technology. And I would have thought that apart from the digital divide, the drawbacks that information technology divides the world into the haves and the have-nots do not have access, on the whole, information technology seems to be fairly harmless. There are threats to privacy, and which I'll come to in a moment, very soon, and there may be a minimum regulation required for that reason. And thirdly, there are some technologies that are in between those that are obviously worrisome and obviously benign. And I think, apart from nanotechnology, biotechnology, we will have to say a bit more, falls into that third category, where people are divided about the degree of control that is needed. Now, I once organized a conference in Sri Lanka of the Society for International Development, in which I invited Arthur Clarke, who was a very distinguished science fiction writer, and a man who's taking entirely the opposite view, Ivan Illich, who I think died earlier this year than he, but he was also a very, very articulate and very great anti-technology man. And I wanted them to debate. And it was a very interesting debate, because Ivan Illich, who then still was a ordained minister of the Catholic Church, he said, after Arthur Clarke had described in very glowing terms the future that is entirely run by robot and everything will be done by machines and human beings will be completely freed of any kind of work, he said, well, he was then an ordained priest of the Catholic Church, Ivan Illich said, I wouldn't like to make love to a robot. But that seemed odd for a Catholic priest to say, but he has left the church, of course, and he has actually, I believe, fallen in love. But since then, I've read a recent chapter by Howard Rheingold on virtual reality and teledildonics, who predicts that we shall be literally embracing technology. The technology will be a substitute for human lovemaking. There's a British writer called Martin Rees, who is a professor in Cambridge University, Cambridge, England, and who is Britain's Astronomer Royal, and who has bet $1,000 that an instance of bioterror or bioerror, as he calls it, it could be an error, it could be imposed by a terrorist, will take 1 million lives before the year 2020. And then he also has a bet. No, he hasn't got a bet. That is the bet that he has. He says that there is a 50-50 chance that humanity will survive the 21st century. And he's not a doomsman. He's a very sensible guy. In fact, his book in this country is called Our Final Hour. In England, it's called Our Final Century. And he wanted a question mark. But his publishers, both in England and America, prohibit him from putting in a question mark because they thought they would catch a wider audience. And he's a very, very sensible man. I've read the book, and it's a very balanced view of the future. But he has this 1 million death and 50-50 chance of survival. Now, I don't want to scare you, because I want to report on having been asked by David Frankfurt to bend my mind to the longer-term future, having thought of, wrote some of the literature on this field, there is an important distinction, which not many people realize, between a prophet and a forecaster. And just before this meeting, David Frankfurt told me that the endower of the center, Pardee, himself was a forecaster. So I wonder whether he was also a bit of a prophet. But you remember the prophet Jonah in the Bible didn't know the difference between the two, because when he predicted the production of Nineveh, because the people had fallen into bad habits and didn't behave themselves, but then they did reform their ways when they were told that they would be destroyed by God, he was very angry with God because he thought he had made the wrong prophecy, the wrong forecast. But forecast is different from prophecy, because the function of a good prophet is to mend people's ways, to make them improve themselves and behave better. But Jonah was furious with God. He mistook the function of a prophet for that of a forecaster. On the other hand, it seems to me that prophets of doom, if they know that they are prophets and that their function is to improve people's way of behaving, have it very easy, because they cannot in a way be wrong. Either their forecasts turn out to be true, in which case they can always say, well, I told you so, or their forecasts turn out to be false, although I must say the first Club of Rome reporters don't quite fall into that category. They can say, well, people have mended their ways and have improved their ways, and therefore we have fulfilled our functions as prophet. Now, there are, as Martin Rees has said, technological errors and technological terror. I'll have to say a little bit about each. Error, of course, is from the Titanic in 1912, via the Challenger in 86 to the Columbia in 2003. These are errors, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, explosion of a chemical factory in Toulouse in 2001, the sunken tanker Prestige off the coast of Spain, like the Valdez, Corrales Valdez, oil spills, etc. These are technical errors. Before the errors, not so much technological, but disasters were inflicted on the world by natural forces, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, and hurricanes. But now we have more concern with human agency. And therefore, we have, and still at the introduction of all this, we have to talk about technological discoveries. It's interesting to note, you know, that how blind people were to the implications of their discoveries. Ernest Rutherford, the greatest nuclear physicist of his time, dismissed as new moonshine the practical relevance of nuclear energy, of ever finding any kind of practical application. It was pure theoretical. The pioneers of radio regarded wireless transmission as a substitute for the telegraph, ships to shore communication, but never thought it would become a medium of mass entertainment, broadcasting to a wider, very wide public. Neither the great mathematician John F. Neumann nor the IBM founder Thomas J. Watson envisaged the need for more than a few computers in the entire country. There are certain technological problems which can be described, which I describe as not so much wrong or misguided or misleading as that we are suffering from success, or as some people describe it, a second-generation problem. You solve one set of problems, the scientific confidence, you know, asserts that that there is a solution to every problem. But experience shows that there is a problem to every solution, and indeed very often more than one problem to every solution. And there are those that produce what are called second-generation problems in technology. The rapid growth of industry showed up agriculture as a slow cause, the need to invest in agriculture and to do something about the new varieties. That did eventually follow. We had a problem to that solution. We had the new varieties of wheat and rice. But they produced another set of second-generation problems relating to plant diseases, to inequality of the impact, to unemployment, etc. Equally, of course, the great problem about which so many people were worried for a long time, the population explosion to which I've already referred to, was caused by something that we should all welcome, the rapid and effective reduction of mortality without the corresponding rapid and effective reduction in fertility. We introduced modern death rates into societies which still had an ancient birth rate, and that produced the population growth. But nobody can have wished not to have reduced the mortality rates in some people. So that was another case of second-generation problem. Now, of course, with the discovery of quite effective, the discovery and adoption of quite effective methods of birth control, family planning, etc., we have the problem about which many more people begin to think now of aging societies, of declining birth rates, and the social and political problems of a world in which for many people their only kinsmen and kinswomen would be their ancestors. It would be a world in which more lonely people without siblings, uncles, aunts, and cousins. That is the one child or even less than one child kind of society. So these are problems created by a first set of solutions to one set of problems, which create another set of problems later on. We recently read again some years ago we talked about jobless growth, and now we talk about a jobless recovery, where the recovery is not accompanied by the creation of any job, instead by the reduction of job. But again, in principle, you see, jobless growth and jobless recovery should be welcome because it means that productivity grows ahead of work. And since most people don't terribly enjoy the kind of work they have to do, that would be a benefit if the spread were even. Of course, the fact that some people are completely unemployed and don't have access to resources is not so welcome. It's deplorable. The education in many developing countries, of course, has led to the influx from the country to the towns. and from the towns abroad, the so-called brain drain, professional education, professional manpower, the emigration. But again, one wouldn't want to not to have the people educated. I mean, it does create second generation problems. Equally, I think the currently advocated outward-looking, export-oriented policies in many developing countries, I think many people who advocate passionately exports and free trade forget that in most cases the successful exports were built on periods of closing off, of inward-looking, of building your foundation, your infrastructure, and your industrial technological base of inward-looking policies. And then you can open up if you do that properly. There's a book by Edward Tenner, which is called Why Things Bite Back, Technology at the Range of Unintended Consequences. There are, I call it something else from what we previously talked about. It is really counterproductive, not in terms of other results, but in terms of the own aim of the whole technology. That is something quite different from the ones that we've talked so far. The internet has also followed the law of unintended consequences. It is not side effects like nuclear power that one deplores, but it is really achieving the opposite of what it's intended to have, what it was originally intended. Perhaps the most obvious example, of course, is congestion caused by the motor car. The motor car, which is supposed to bring us faster to certain places, now has produced blockages and congestion and delays. You move faster on foot and even faster on a bicycle than by car, say, between my old college, Balliol in Oxford, and Morden Bridge. I don't know, maybe they've reformed it since I've left, but in the time when I was still there, it was almost impossible. It took much longer by car than it took on foot. Medicines and hospitals, of course, called, but again, Ivan Illich has pointed to what he's called iatrogenic illnesses or diseases. And recently I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that was called How to Prevent the Hospital from Making You Sicker. And I remember on one occasion when we lived in Sussex, my wife going into hospital with one minor ailment and coming out with five major ailments caused by the hospital infection and letting her drop off a stretcher, etc., and similar mishaps. There are some people who think, and sometimes I'm inclined to think the same, that school and universities make us more stupid rather than more intelligent, don't educate us. You remember Orwell once said, George Orwell, this is the sort of thing that you could learn only at the university. Prisons produce criminals. 63% of freed prisoners are jailed within 3 years of serious crime. And prisons make for more prisoners. And, of course, they cause AIDS, but that's another matter. There are more recidivists than cured criminals in America's prisons. We know that agriculture ruins the soil, that irrigation produces salination, etc. Filters of water purification turn out to be breeding grounds of bacteria and cause cancer, as we know. Injuries tripled, apparently. I must take these facts on trust. Injuries tripled. Helmets and other protective gear have made football more dangerous than rugby. Neck and touch spine injuries tripled after the debut of football helmets. Antibiotics, we all know, of course, have produced the strains that are resistant to antibiotics, and that means, of course, a more serious attack on illnesses. Tourism in many places has killed tourism, devaluation versus the balance. But there are numerous other type of examples that I could give you. So those are a few ways which I wanted to mention by way of introduction to the whole question of my real five or six concerns that I'll come to now or perhaps next week when I talk about these technological nightmares, which are not just nightmares from which you wake up, but which have some real component of concern or worry. Well, the first one with which I want to begin, I call, I'm not sure that's a very good title, The Need for a Cultural Revolution Caused by the Information Revolution, Information Technology. When in the old days, when you had, say, 8 or 10 ditch diggers and somebody supervising them from above, he could see to it that they were doing their work, and if somebody slacked, they could tick him off and he could tell him to do his job. When you nowadays have a computer operator in a bank, it's no good having him supervised, because the supervisor might just as well do the work himself. So he has to assume the responsibility. He has to assume a different attitude from the ditch diggers, who probably would have slacked had there not been a supervisor. It requires something that pays attention to things that economists don't pay very much attention to, but which is very important, which is attitudes as opposed to skills and aptitudes. Skills and aptitudes can in a way be measured, at least the input into training can be measured. But attitudes are much more difficult to measure, and therefore economists have tended to neglect them. But what kind of attitudes are called for by the information technology? And the advanced technology that the information technology has produced, that means the smaller number of skilled people supply their services over a wider range, producing what economists call the winner-takes-all effect, where only the best do well and those lucky few command enormous large incomes. This has been so far the case in sports, in business and entertainment. The invention, for instance, of the phonograph has done this for singers. Instead of having to be bound by a present audience, you can, by making records or discs, you can reach the masses. The invention of the motion picture has done it for actors, for film stars. And proliferating communication information technology may do the same for many other occupations. What is the effect on employment of the information revolution? Now, there again, see, I put to you, as you will discover, no answers but many questions and problems that I've come to ask myself in the course of preparing for these lectures. What is the effect on employment? Does the information revolution mean that high skills are going to be more rewarded and the low skills? Two questions, really. One is, what are low skills due to? Are low skills the result of genetic endowment given by nature? Or can they in principle be augmented and increased by training and by nurture? And the second one, what is going to be the demand for low skills in this new information technology society? Are they going to be reduced? Are we going not to need any? Or is it going to be increased? I don't know the answer to either of these questions. The Department of Labor, I think, in the U.S., predicts a large increase in the demand for people with low skills, people like health workers, nurses, childcare workers, special education teachers, gardeners, plumbers, valet parkers, etc. I mean, there are many types of activities. Admittedly, many of them in the public sector, which is not a very good reputation these days, and they're not very well paid, of course, and we may have to reform this. But according to the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, many of these jobs are likely to grow faster than the high-skilled jobs. Others, of course, may say that this is not so, that these low-skilled jobs are going to be eliminated by machines. Machines can take their place, and these people will no longer be wanted. I've been rereading for the second time before these lectures a very interesting novel by Kurt Vonnegut called Player Piano, which describes a future nightmare society, a dystopia, or Jeremy Bentham called it a catatopia, in which the divine right of machines, efficiency, organization, management, has triumphed, and there's a very large underclass of low IQ people who don't have jobs, who are basically unemployed, or they have makeshift jobs which are not highly respected, and there's a small group of highly skilled, high IQ people. Everybody's measured according to their IQs, and they are allocated to the highly paid, well looked after managerial class. The unemployed don't suffer from deprivation. They are looked after, they have plenty of goodies. but they lack what John Rawls calls perhaps the most important primary good, which is self-respect. And eventually, of course, they revolt, although interesting enough, the revolt is led by one of the Haikyuu, by two or three of the Haikyuu people. They are not even capable of revolting themselves. The interesting thing in this novel is what deprived the underclass of self-respect was the fact that it was an equality of opportunity society, a complete meritocracy. Everybody got to their jobs entirely deserved by their IQ. Who became a manager, and who became outside the managerial era. If you were to allocate these jobs through lottery or by the accident of birth, there would have been no problems with self-respect of the underclass. So this is, again, our problem, as I said at the moment, with jobless growth. Is it, in fact, the result of genetic endowment, or is it a matter of training and skills and that you can acquire after a while? And for those of us who are not Luddites, another question, of course, is whether only the unskilled jobs can be replaced by computers. But it may also be that some of the more skilled ones, the highly skilled ones, for instance, there has been a computer program recently which enables you to make medical diagnoses, which previously were made, of course, by doctors. If it is the case that computers can take the work of highly skilled people too, then again will produce quite a different result. It might lead to a lessening of the gap in wages and rewards and remuneration of the skilled and the unskilled. I think the question is, as I said, there are two questions which one has to answer. One, can these skills in principle be acquired through training and through a good environment, family, schooling, etc.? Or are they given by the genetic lottery in the game? And is it only the skilled and only the unskilled who are going to be penalized, or is it also the skilled?
You've been listening to Professor Paul Streeton in his first of two lectures, together entitled Technological Nightmares. Next week, we'll hear Professor Streeton's second lecture, in which he examines six technological nightmares in detail. Earlier, we heard the Reverend Drs. Ray and Gloria Hammond delivering from Marsh Chapel the inaugural lecture for Boston University's newly founded Center for African American Religious Research and Education. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skoog and Matt Largy, with help from Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Angel Cuzzelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Tom Asprey. Coming up Monday on Point, a peasant uprising has shut down Bolivia's capital city of La Paz. The people are calling for the president's resignation and an end to globalization as they've known it. Plus, renowned biblical scholar Elaine Pagels on the secret gospel of Thomas and how its suppression nearly 2,000 years ago changed Christianity as we know it today. That's On Point, Monday night at 7 on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is WBUR. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. Make a contribution for the news right now and your name will be entered in a...